Welcome to Tribal. This is Jared Sichel, senior writer with the Jewish Journal. I'm here with comedian Danny LaBelle. Danny, thank you for coming.
Well, this is a place to be to do this podcast. I'm happy to be here.
We're at my apartment in West Hollywood, and I'm wearing my Tuesday best gym clothes, all blue, special for Danny. And so Danny is a stand-up comedian based in L.A. He started off with the Comical Radio podcast in New York, where he launched his comedian career, and he interviewed folks like Chris Rock and George Carlin, and now in L.A., he's performing on a regular basis around the city, and he also hosts the Modern Day Philosophers podcast, which is comedians discussing philosophy, and he also hosts the Mostly Bull Market podcast, which is investment advice and money news from financial advice and money news from you and another comedian.
Right.
And I think it's mostly bull market because it would be a total bull market, except the people listening to it are probably taking the advice a little too seriously.
It's mostly bull because we don't know what we're talking about.
Okay, okay. I thought it was going to be bull for everyone who's not listening and bear for everyone who is listening.
No, it's mostly we don't know what we're talking about.
So thanks for coming. And I'm looking forward. I have a whole list of questions to pepper.
All right.
You're basically my image of stand-up comedians now, because you're going to be the first comedian who I've interviewed on Tribal. So I'm going to ask you everything I've wanted to ask comedians.
Okay.
First, what is a stand-up comedian's workload like? How often are you performing? I'd imagine almost all those performances are in the evening. So what are you doing during the daytime? Fill me in. What's it like to be a comedian?
Loaded question. So, what is a comedian's workload is subjective. It's basically different from every comedian because you're your own boss. So, I'm sorry, it's probably different for every comedian because you're your own boss. And that really comes down to how tough of a boss are you on yourself. So, one thing I've found is the more you push yourself to do, the more gets done. Now, this is a crazy idea, but the more you push yourself to do, the real thought I was going to get through there is the more successful, usually. A lot of comedians that don't do very much wonder why they're not more successful.
What does doing consist of? Does it mean more writing, more performing?
It's all of the above. It's just writing new material, generating new material, emailing people to get on shows, but also podcasting, making video content now. I started doing that, but for a lot of people, just coming up with ideas, being creative. That's what it is. It's being creative.
How much? I don't know if I'm looking for a percentage term, but I'm just throwing an idea out there. How much of the work you do, and most comedians do, you know, if you're Chris Rock, you can make a ton of money basically whenever you want. If you're not at that level of popularity around the world, how much of what you do is an investment in yourself? Meaning, I may not be making money for what I'm doing right now. You know, when I put up a podcast or I do an open mic or something like that, what's the trade-off between I'm doing this for money or I'm doing this because this is simply the work I have to put in now in order to reach that level I want to reach?
98% the latter. Until you're making money in a real way. Most comedians, especially I found this from doing the Mostly Bull Market podcast, and I discuss finances with comedians, and what I found is that I'm not alone in that I don't make money. I mean, I make money, but I'm not making money in the sense that an adult person who's trying to live a real life and buy a house and have kids makes money, you know? I make money in the sense that, like, a high school student who has a summer job makes money. It's not sustainable, but most of the work I'm doing is an investment in myself and hopefully in my future. And I lost my thought, but I was going to answer something else you asked. Huh.
So how often, you know, you said we were talking before we started the show that you take, you take improv classes pretty often.
Yeah.
And you're taking some right now?
I've been taking improv classes on and off for the past 14 years. Starting at UCB before anybody knew what UCB was.
Was that in New York?
In New York, in this different theater than it's in now. And I just like to do that to sort of stay sharp, stay active, stay sharp. And I think it helps work a certain muscle in the brain for writing and also for performance. It's good because it keeps you uninhibited to an extent. I think a lot of people I see on stage that are very writerly comedians could be much better comedians if they worked...
If they drank a few beers before they went on stage.
Yeah, I think they're just a little bit scared. You know, it is scary. The performance aspect of stand-up is much scarier than the writing part of stand-up because, you know, writers are generally timid, quiet people, and just reading your writing on stage or reciting your writing on stage is a big leap. And then performing that writing is a much bigger leap, you know? So you see a lot of people that are in the comedy clubs that you're like, oh, they're kind of a 25% performer, 75% writer, you know? Like a really good comedian's kind of like a 50-50 almost. Or 100-100, you know, really.
Do you get nervous before performances?
I wish I got more nervous because it's good to have those nerves. I haven't been getting nervous lately, which is like worrying me because it's not good. It's good to get nervous.
Have you noticed a performance difference when you are nervous versus when you aren't?
Well, it's a different kind of nervousness, you know? Like, there are different nervousness. There's, like, nervous that you can use the nervous energy, and then there's nervous where it's just going to be destructive to what you're doing. Like, if you're, like, new nervous, new to comedy, new to performance nervous, that can actually hinder you. But if you're, like, experienced and you know how to use the nervous energy, then it could really enhance. Did I not answer your question?
No,
at all?
You did. What goes into preparing a set? So you have, you know, when you are performing, I don't know, when was your last, when was your last performance?
Two nights ago.
Where was it?
In Santa Monica at a bar.
And how long was that set for?
15 minutes.
And is that a set you've been giving, is that a set you're pretty experiencing giving right now?
No, actually, it was foolishly all new material.
What was the
theme? Foolishly because no, I was like, let me start out with new material and break in this new material, and it was going so well that I got a little cocky, and I was like, I'm not going to do any of the old stuff, only doing all these new things, and then I kind of it waned a little bit, and I lost momentum. But and then I said, I probably should have switched back to the tried and true stuff. What else?
What goes into preparing a new set? Into write? Are you like anyone else at your computer trying to write it out?
No. Never. I've never been like that, though. For me, it's taking an idea and sort of running the idea by friends of mine, by my brother, by my wife, and then I just take it to the stage and try and, I think a lot of, as I get older and wiser as a comedian, what I've figured out is that most of my ideas are very funny. This is going to sound cocky and arrogant.
No, it sounds super cocky. It's okay.
Continue. Most of my ideas are great comedic ideas. They're very funny. But where they sometimes fall short is articulating them. So as I've gotten older, what I figured out is that it's just articulation issues more than it's an issue with, because I know what's funny. And I'll tell you why it's almost not cocky and arrogant, because I know it's funny to me. And
well, if you didn't think it was funny, there'd be no reason for you to be a comedian.
Right.
Any comedian who said, yeah, I come up with ideas, but they're really bad, I would say, why is anyone listening to you then?
Right.
It would actually be a lot of chutzpah to go up on stage and transmit ideas that you don't think are funny.
That'd be funny.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here. This is Tribal. I'm here with comedian Danny LaBelle. And during that break, you'll have time to think about how to articulate a recent funny idea you had. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Tribal. This is Jared Sechel. I'm with Danny LaBelle. And during the break, Danny, you were flipping, I think you were flipping through your phone and looking at some observations you had, which were, say funny ideas, and you had some time to explain them to the listeners.
So funny idea is like a seed, right? So this would be a seed. It wouldn't be...
So this idea, you were shopping at the Home Depot Lawn and Garden Center when this came about.
Sure, I'll go with you on that. But basically, a funny idea is not a bit. If I'm going to tell you this now and you think you're going to hear a full bit, you're not. This is just a little seed that I know is funny, that if I care for it right.
Has to be nurtured and watered.
Yeah, if I water it and put it in the sun in just the right way, it could blossom into a beautiful joke. But, So this is about the fact that my brain plays tricks on me all the time. I have very bad hypochondria, so I think I'm sick, and this happens several times a year. I'll check myself into the ER, and I'm pretty convinced that I'm dying of different things.
This is real.
This is real. I'm setting it up for you.
Okay.
I'll give you some context.
Got it. So you're Jewish, is what you're saying?
Yeah. It's a tough thing because I've tried to work through it in therapy and stuff, and it's been good because it used to happen a lot more frequently, and then I thought I was cured, but then it started happening again. It's an anxiety. It's a manifestation of anxiety, and it really dates back to like my childhood where. I've always been overweight, and my dad has got very bad anxiety, and he always would put these ideas in my head that I'm going to die young because I'm overweight. And these aren't crazy theories. I mean, it could happen, but he would always, you're going to, by the time you're 30, you're going to have diabetes. They're going to cut your legs off.
How old are you?
I'm 33, so I still got legs. Thank God, still going strong with them. But you're going to have heart disease. You're not going to make it to 30. All these things. And I'd be like, yeah, okay, all right. But they kind of like, they get into your head. And I start thinking, I'm dying. It's happening. He's right, you know? And it's not just things that he predicted. It becomes all kinds of things. Like, I thought I had AIDS at one point. Because I was in France and I ate a very crispy burger and it cut a hole in my bottom lip and I went to a nightclub with this other comedian and wound up making out with this girl and then I found out that she was a prostitute and then I thought AIDS had traveled into the hole in my lip through the making out with her.
I think it starts as HIV.
Right, I don't know. I don't know anything medically, but... So this is the context to this idea that I'm going to, this little seed.
Oh, okay, so now you're about to give me the seed.
Right.
You were just giving me the soil there.
Right, that was just the soil. Here's the seed. I wind up going to the hospital, and I find out there's nothing wrong with me, and it's a very short-lived happiness, because then I realize I feel this crappy in good health. So that's the most recent that I've written down.
So then what do you do to water that idea?
So... The fact that...
Because it still just sounds like you're Jewish. Like, that just sounds like someone, like, more like a Jewish mother, but whatever.
Yeah, so...
So how do you feed that seed to turn into a beautiful plant that's probably ridden with illnesses?
Well, the very first step is what I just did, like, running it by someone like you, and the reaction I get from you at the end where you're like, You know, that's
what it wasn't supposed to get. It was a
right. It's not. Because it's still a baby. It hasn't grown into a ha yet. But it got what it was supposed to get. If it got nothing,
you were looking for the stare, for the slight exhale through the nose.
Yeah,
through the mouth would have been very different. But mine was through the nose. You were looking for that flare of the nostrils, right. And you got it.
Yeah. So I got what I needed from that, and then.
You're done with me. You got what you came here for.
Right. I'll see you later. The next step will be like making it much less wordy to articulate the idea, the articulation.
The soil.
It took me forever.
Maybe less soil.
I love that you're sticking with the soil, but I'm sticking with the seed. So whatever.
No, but they work together. They're complementary. Right.
So less soil, I guess. It's the better I can articulate this idea that I just told you. Once I've got that down, then I'll try to add little funny things leading up to the funny idea. Right? So I'll go back into it, and I'll find funny ways to convey the idea, funny words maybe, funny language to say it in, and then funny maybe tidbits along the way to get to that idea. And then I'll start doing that on stage, and I'll get a nice polish on it, right? And as I continue doing it, I'll develop a rhythm for it. The joke will have, every joke has a rhythm, you know, or something, whatever. And different comedians have their own rhythms, but I'll develop a rhythm for the joke. I'll find several laughs within the joke. And then, you know, just I'll find a way to get that into like a big laugh.
I'm going to stick with my soil metaphor. When I was 18, 19, couple buddies of mine, we ran a summer landscaping company. Mm. And when we realized the soil, the mulch we would buy, we would usually buy mulch from like Home Depot or Lowe's or something, but it was pretty expensive per bag, and that cost really added up. And so we ended up taking, I think it was usually my parents' minivan, to the county dump. Mm-hmm. Where they had a massive like mound of soil. Who really knows what was in there? And it was free. You just go there with a shovel. And so we would just fill up this minivan, which people sat in also. We filled up the minivan with this soil from the county dump.
Uh-huh.
And so I feel like I'm not comparing your soil to the county dump soil, but okay, I feel like but I feel like the process of nurturing a joke sort of just like it. You're refining and you're upgrading. Mm-hmm. And then by the time you actually make it a public product, you're trying to get it to the best reasonable thing that you can get it to.
Exactly. And after all that, it might not be that great. And then I'll just abandon it.
And then you just do something else. But I mean, I would have to guess many, many, you know, it's like the inverted pyramid idea that you start with a ton of things at the top and it just filters down. And what comes out is much less than what was at the top. And I'm sure it's the same in journalism. I'm sure in any type of writing, many professions, I'm sure in comedy, many of the ideas that every comedian, including great comedians, are coming up with are either really not going to work on stage. They're just not that funny and they just throw them out. But they come up with a ton of ideas and then they might use 10% of them. But those 10% can kill it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like, no, that's total crap? Or is that true?
No, I mean, when you're saying kill it, you're saying like do really well,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree with you.
So when you are in an improv class, that's very collaborative, right?
Yeah. I mean, what I like about improv class is that it makes you think quick and it forces you to listen. It's very good for podcasting. So it's good for that. Builds that skill set as well, because you have to listen to the other person. That's the collaboration and react to what they're saying. I think a lot of podcasts that I think are not very well done that I've heard are just the host.
Like Tribal?
No. Just the host has something they're dying to say, and you can almost feel it. Like the guest is speaking, and the host is just like, let me wait till he's finished saying that so I can say my thing. And you can get caught into that, but just reacting to what people say and listening to them and That's a good skill to keep sharp. So I like improv class for that.
Does it help you in your stand-up? Does it help you with stand-up comedy or only with podcasts?
No, it helps in stand-up comedy and in the performance element. Like I was saying earlier, like when you're in an improv class, it's goofy, and it like a lot of stand-up can make you feel take yourself very seriously, because you're like you're at it alone pretty much, and nobody's forcing you out of your comfort zone. You are in complete control, and nobody's gonna tell you that's not how to do your act. So if you're comfortable, you may stay stagnant and be comfortable. When you're in an improv class, you're kind of forced to be goofy. You're forced to embarrass yourself in front of other people. And the more you kind of do that, the less embarrassed you are and the less inhibited you are when you're on stage. So I like to use it in that respect to transfer over to stand-up.
Has any comedian worth his salt bombed on stage?
Well, every comedian's worth their salt has bombed on stage.
We will take a quick break, and then when you come back, I want to hear a bombing story. This is Tribal. I'm Jared Sechel here with comedian Danny LaBelle, and we will be right back. Welcome back. This is Tribal. I'm Jared Sechel here with Danny LaBelle. And Danny, I want to hear about a bombing experience from on stage where just was not happening that night.
So I want to say this was 8 years ago, maybe more. One was the height of the Chappelle show, whenever that was.
Yeah. That was a great show.
It was a great show. I was at the Boston Comedy Club, which was at the time renamed the Comedy Village, which at this time of this recording, doesn't exist anymore. But it was a legendary comedy club in the village. And my friend was running a show, and I was on the show. And in walks Dave Chappelle. And he says, I'd like to do some stage time, but I don't want to knock all the comedians off the show who were booked. So can I take over hosting the show? And then I will bring the comedians on stage. And they said, of course, you know, it's Dave Chappelle. They'd say, of course, anyway, but it was the height of the Chappelle show. So it was a, of course, you know. Everybody was pumped. And there were a few of us that had slots on that show, and we were super psyched because we were going to get brought on stage by Dave Chappelle. And then he sat and he watched the comedians and he was laughing. It was very cool. And everybody wanted to impress Dave Chappelle.
Right, you don't know what can come of that.
Right, and also just at the very least what could come of it is you walk away being like, man, I made Dave Chappelle laugh, you know? So my friends go on, they do great, and I'm ready. And I was doing very well at the time as well. I was starting to really hit on stage. It was like around the point where I was starting to find my groove. So I was like, oh, I'm going to blow Dave Chappelle away in my head. I'm like, I'm going to do it. I got this. And I go up with like a risky opener. I thought this would be funny if I got up and I go, here's what I hate.
About black people. Oh, yes, I got it.
So, and with like a nice pause in there, right? And that got a little bit of a laugh, a little awkward. But also, we're heading into like maybe 1 or 2 in the morning. I'm not sure exactly when, but because Dave Chappelle was doing material, he was doing like 45 minutes between each comedian. So it was getting very late. And
was he killing it?
He was killing it. the whole time. But I remember I did this joke. It got an okay laugh.
Did you audible into that joke because Chappelle was there, or was that your planned first joke?
Oh, no, just because Chappelle was there.
Okay.
I thought it'd be funny. And then a bunch of people got up and left because it was very, very late. And I just remember, like, I saw them leave, and I looked over at Dave Chappelle, and I just kind of, it's like losing your balance. I just lost my comedic balance on stage. I think I said something to them as they left, and I didn't get a response, and I didn't get a laugh. And I looked over at Chappelle, and all of a sudden I got really nervous, and I sort of lost my balance comedically. Speaking, not that I fell off the stage or something, but I felt like I lost my comedic balance. I wasn't stable anymore on stage comedically, and the jokes from that point on just got more and more horrendous responses. You know, it was just it just got quieter and quieter till the point where I'm like, oh, I'm officially on stage bombing in front of Dave Chappelle, like. Just people are just staring at me like, I remember the looks were kind of like, is this guy even funny at all? Like nothing this guy's saying is like
remotely. Maybe you should try a different career.
Remotely funny. I thought the crowd must be like, what is this? Like, and I remember like the sweat dripping down my back and, you know, my shirt obviously, but you know, I just remember like, I was like, oh, this is happening. Could you just
not wait till you were off the stage?
Was horrible. Yeah, every second felt like forever, and I wanted to like bury myself at the end of it because I was beating myself up really hard in my head. I'm like, you suck, you're terrible, yeah, you have no business being on stage at all. And all your friends are gonna go on to do great in comedy, and you suck. You know, because look how everybody did well in front of Chappelle. You can't. You fold under pressure. You're not that funny. Everything. I was feeling really low, and I was going to, like, sneak out of the club. And Dave Chappelle gets on stage, and the first thing he goes, he's laughing. He goes, damn, that, some things are, I'm going to do my best Chappelle impression for you, are cosmically funny. Some things are I can't do it right now, but sometimes I can.
That was good. That was good.
He goes, here's what I hate about black people. That is cosmically funny shit. And he goes, that takes balls to open with that. He focused on the one thing I did remotely right. And he went on a riff for like maybe 2 to 3 minutes about how great it was. Because he must have known how awful I felt.
Because he's been there.
And especially he must have known what it meant for me to perform in front of him, and for that to not go well. And I think it was like the kindest thing, you know, that he could have possibly done was to like go up there and just, he's grasping for straws to find something to praise in that debacle. But he did it, and
he could have ragged on you.
He could have easily, and everybody would have been on board. He could have been like, that guy sucks. That's the worst stand-up comedy I've ever seen.
It's a really good impression.
Thanks.
Do you do a lot of impressions?
No.
That's pretty good. We're winding down here. But
why can't we wind up?
Wind up? It's late, man. So we could... We have to get to this just because it's America and Donald Trump is going to be the nominee. But... the way I sort of imagine Trump for comedians, I studied accounting in college, and one of my professors, John Page, is like just Southern New Orleans. Shout out to John Page. He's not listening. small guy, and he was just like, do you know what government and laws mean to me? Job security. And that's kind of how I see Donald Trump for comedians. He's job security for the comedy world.
Yeah, especially for
if you're the ones who are, writer.
You know, satirists and political comics.
Do you ever get into political comedy?
No, I've never believed in the political system, and it's almost like I always felt like comedians making, and I know they have their value and everything, but I almost felt like, or feel like, comedians making fun of politicians is almost validating. It's like making fun of wrestlers that say, "I'm gonna get you," or whatever they say. I don't watch, obviously. I don't watch
WWE stuff.
WWE stuff, where it's like, when he comes in here, I'm gonna take this thing and slam him over the head, and I'm gonna break his back, and I'm gonna distribute his body parts to the audience, you know? And then somebody being like, "Well, he didn't break his back, and he didn't distribute his body parts to the audience." It's like, yeah, but we know he's not going to, because it's an act. It's a lie, and it's an act, and you're making fun of something that's already funny. So, I've always
found it. That's your optimistic view. What's your cynical view of politics?
It almost feels easy, and there are people who do it really well, like Bill Maher, who I don't always agree with his stance on things, but I always find him very funny.
The difference would be that many politicians take themselves seriously. The guys in the ring at WWE, they have internalized that it is an act.
Yeah. But I feel like if you're paying attention, you see it's an act. I mean, it's always been an act. The politicians know it's an act. No, I didn't. They do know it's an act. They know that this is a game they're playing. They know when they say, "I promise you this and this and this and this," they're not going to be able to deliver. They're smart. They're manipulating people's hopes.
So really, your the live C-SPAN feed of Capitol Hill would be the stand-up comedy, and the stand-up comedians who are trying to riff on that. That's tangential.
Yeah, it's comedy making fun of comedy.
Exactly.
By the way, I like this. You have this big New York poster here.
Yeah.
And
have you been looking at how old some of the ads are?
Right. I like that it has the Curse of the Jade Scorpion movie poster, which is like an obscure Woody Allen film.
Yellow taxi cabs. I mean, you know, taxis are gone.
Not in New York, they're not.
Yeah, they're still there. And then as a Mountain Dew, not Planet Hollywood. Is Planet Hollywood still a thing?
I think so.
And what was Planet Hollywood? Was it like an arcade?
Oh, you never... Planet Hollywood's a themed restaurant of Hollywood, where they have like iconic...
Homeless guys with rusty screwdrivers just walking around and...
Yeah, like the real Hollywood, that'd be
eating your food off your plate.
An Elvis impersonator on meth. And they have, like, the outfits that, like, famous actors wore in famous movies, like, hanging up on the walls. It's like, you ever been to the Rainforest Cafe?
I think once, yeah.
You know, like, you know, themed restaurants. Yeah. It's a Hollywood movie-themed restaurant.
Is there an ideal type of audience for you?
That's a great question.
Drunk.
No, I'm. That's why it's a great question, because on the one hand, it would be nice if the audience is really loose and fun and laughing, but then it's almost less challenging to the performance, to the material and everything. You're like, okay, so it feels good, but what am I really getting here, you know? Then there's the audience that's a little more discerning and a little more critical, and making them laugh might be more of a challenge, but then you're like, you know what, why can't you guys be a little looser? Who the hell are you, you know? Who the hell are you to be so critical? You're out for a good time, right? What are you, all out to be critics, you know? So, you know, there's like this Twilight Zone episode, famous one, where the guy dies and goes to what he thinks is heaven. And he's at a casino and he just wins every time. And all the girls love him. And just like, you know, just everything he does, it's, you know, he wants a drink, he has a drink. And then he realizes, like, da-da-da! he's in hell, you know? It's hell because getting everything you want is hell because, you know, there's no fun in it anymore. There's no fun in playing poker knowing that he's always going to get the win, you know, or talking to the girl and knowing it's 100% going to go. So if every audience was great, it would be hell, you know? It would be that Twilight Zone episode.
You would never build that muscle.
Yeah, the only reason to do this is for the challenge. I mean, none of the stuff I do is going to be remembered. That's just the likelihood of things. Even if I become a huge success over the next few years, which could happen, there are so many huge success comedians that I could start naming them, and you'd eventually lose track of who I'm even talking about. You might be like, okay, I know him. I think I know him. I know the name. I haven't seen his stuff. And, oh, she sounds familiar. And the next thing you know, I don't know that name at all. And now, fast forward 20 years from now, people probably won't know the ones that you knew. There's so much stuff out there, more than ever. And even success is such a short-lived thing in show business. Like, you have a few good years, and I don't think it... Comedy is not like music either. It's like most old comedy albums don't hold up. They're interesting to listen to for me, but I always see them for a dollar at thrift shops. Nobody even wants them, the records. Whereas like an old music album would be like $15 for a well-known band. A well-known comedian's album is like a dollar. Nobody wants old comedy. Nobody wants to listen to old comedy. Except like a few nerds that are like comedy dorks. But the whole point is, everything I'm doing now is for the challenge now. Otherwise, it's just about making money.
And it's worth it in the moment.
And
when you can, bring down the house with a bit, with a routine, in the moment, that's worth it. You're not doing it because they're going to remember every line you said. An hour after they leave, they're going to forget. I forget most, when I watch a stand-up special on Netflix or something, I remember 3 of the 40 jokes that they said.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it's great to remember anything, but it's worth it even just for the laughter in that moment.
It doesn't matter. The material is inconsequential. It's about the exchange between the performer and the audience in terms of the giving and taking. Like, giving the audience a laugh, giving them an emotional, you know, a little buzz, emotionally
taking
a little high.
Taking their money.
And, yeah, sure, it's all about taking that money. And then for the performer, it's that challenge, you know? And it's that moment. So there's two things I think a performer gets out of it, and one thing an audience member gets out of it.
When you're clicking and firing on all cylinders up there on the stage, is there a comedy high that you feel?
Oh yeah. Yeah, and I think some people are addicted to that high too. Like, that's like a very dangerous pitfall. And you know why I said pitfall like that? I don't think I've ever said pitfall.
I don't know why.
I think that might be the debut of pitfall, the word pitfall coming out of my mouth. But that's a dangerous pitfall, I think, that a lot of comedians pitfall into. Because
I don't think you can use pitfall as a verb.
I'm sure you can't, but I did it anyway, breaking the rules. A lot of comedians fall into this thing where they're like, oh, I want to get that high, that comedy high. And it sucks because they stay with what's safe material-wise and what works and what's been developed. And then they wind up not working on new stuff. I've seen guys that have been doing things for like, you know, 10 years maybe, the same jokes, because they know they work and they want that high and they want everyone to say you were great afterwards. And I get it, because there's so little that they get that you want to take that away from them, you know, like I get it, but it sucks because they're not growing and they're not challenging themselves. And I don't know, I I guess it's a different camp, a school of thought. Maybe the high is enough. Maybe as I'm saying it, I'm thinking maybe there's nothing wrong with that. They're just doing their job well, and they don't have to grow as an artist.
Well, if you had to challenge yourself to get the high, then I would say it is worth it. When I played tennis competitively in high school, it was always...
By the way, I was hoping that somehow I would get a story about your competitive tennis days.
I know. My trophies are... My U.S. Open trophies hanging on the wall there. Wimbledon. Wimbledon's the other room. It's actually getting shined right now.
That was one of my goals secretly coming into the podcast.
It's because of this blue fleece, this killer fleece I'm wearing. But in tennis, always, if you're always practicing or playing against an opponent that is below your skill level, it feels, I just kicked his ass. But you're not improving.
Right.
And it's really awesome to ace someone on a serve 87 times in a row. And it feels great in the moment, but you're not improving. You go up against someone who's above your skill level, you're going to get your butt kicked for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, if you can achieve a high by beating that person, then that's definitely a high. That's a high that's totally worth it.
Right. It's a higher high.
That's a true high. The other high really is just like a drug. It's totally, it's false.
But philosophically, it probably doesn't matter which high you get.
All right.
you know what I mean? It probably doesn't matter.
On that note, we'll leave that for part two. But for now, this has been fun. Thank you so much for coming.
Is it over?
It's over, oh God.
On that bleak realization that...
This is all useless. No one's going to listen to this. It'll probably be destroyed by the aliens and wiped from...
But that's okay. It's okay. Here's one thing I picked up on doing my podcast, Modern Day Philosophers. I used to get depressed on that thought that the material won't live on. It doesn't matter. It's meaningless. And then I realized there's a lot of meaning in it. It doesn't matter and it won't live on, but there is a lot of meaning in it, because if you're an artist, you're trying to make art. That's it. You're trying to put art into the world. If you want everyone to know it's your art, that's almost selfish, right? Van Gogh tagged his work with a big Van Gogh. We know it's stylistically his, but I don't think that he cared that everybody knows the name Van Gogh, right? Unless he was a crazy egomaniac, he might have. But I think selfless art should. This is my opinion now. Art should be selfless. Like, you should put art out into the world because you want to beautify the world with your art. Not because you want everybody to know that you're the great beautifier.
The point of it is to impact, and if you get some recognition, you're lucky and you should be grateful for it. But the point is to impact.
Right.
And you know the artist or the whoever it is who's producing something they want to impact, at least while they're living, they will know that what they're doing is having impact. And I think they ultimately that's where they get the pride from.
That's
knowing
that
made a difference, not from their name being on a trophy.
Exactly. And the fact that we could have this conversation, which we already had, so there's no point in saying we could. We did. We had this conversation. And it can go up on iTunes or wherever you put it and get one single download. And that's it.
My mom.
Yeah. It could be your mom. And your mom could take something from it. And implement that somehow into her life.
Not even your wife is listening to it. That's pretty rough.
Two downloads. And something we say could inspire one of those two wonderful women. And they could use that to inspire someone else. And that someone else can inspire. And that inspiration, that strain of inspiration, which is hopefully the same thing that from art, is inspiration, really. That's what the beauty of art is, I think, is inspiration. The inspiration, you're now part of this invisible, inspiring energy that travels through time. And that's where the meaning is.
When you produce something, you have no idea who it's going to touch, how far it's going to go. You probably are not even aware of most of the impact that it has. And on that note, we've just produced a new episode of Tribal with comedian Danny LaBelle.
Thank you again, Danny, and listen next time. I'm Jared Sechelle. You're the best thing.